On this episode of China Unscripted, how Chinese money is invading the Western African country of Mauritania, and what resources are hidden beneath the sea and beneath the sand.
Fish.
There's no fish beneath the sand, Shelley.
Sandfish.
Touché. Welcome to China Uncensored.
Damn it.
We're off to a great start today. Hi, welcome to China Unscripted. I'm Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley Zhang.
And I'm Matt Gnaizda.
And before we get into a very intellectual conversation, I'd like to introduce tonight's tea from our sponsor, Path of Cha. Tonight, we're drinking Yellow Goddess Huangyin Guanyin Wuyi Rock Oolong Tea. That's a long name, but smell it. Taste it.
We've been having a streak of oolongs lately, I think.
There's a huge variety of oolongs. They are the best family of tea, I feel, to really explore. The interesting thing about this tea in particular is that it kind of combines the traits of, like, the Iron Goddess Tie Guan Yin style tea, which is very kind of roasty, with the sort of aroma of the Golden Osmanthos oolong teas. So it's a nice little combination of those two.
Oh, wait, there's a Golden Osmanthus oolong tea?
Oh, yeah. It's way better than the Silver Osmanthus oolong.
Mm. And better than the bronze. The bronze got disowned.
Yeah. Ooh, this has I notice a very nice aftertaste to this. Like, it kind of lingers with fragrant aromas.
It's definitely very floral.
Yeah. That's the Golden Osmanthus oolong thing coming in. What do you think about it, Matt?
It is delicious.
That's great. So, if you'd like to try some delicious tea from Path of Cha and help out China Unscripted, you can get some tea by going to go.pathofcha.com/unscripted. Okay, let's begin the interview. Joining us today is Nasser Wadadi, a Mauritanian-American activist. He's also a Middle Eastern North African consultant. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You bet. So I don't think a lot of Americans really know much about Mauritania. Can you tell us a bit about it? I've heard that's where Atlantis was.
You know, I myself didn't know where it was until I was born there, so don't feel bad. Mauritania is the big box separating Morocco and Senegal off of the Atlantic coast in northwest Africa. It's an immense territory. It's about Texas and a half, if not twice the size of Texas.
Nothing's bigger than Texas.
Well, sorry, Lone Star State. The population, however, is minuscule. It's like got a 4 million population.
Wow.
So it's a
vast
territory.
So it isn't bigger than Texas.
Ooh.
Exactly. So vast, vast, vast arid areas. And also more relevant to our talk about China, interestingly, is it's about 500 to 600 miles of Atlantic coast in some of the richest fishing areas in the world, because the country is basically off of through a stroke of, I guess, geology luck. It's right off the Madeira and the Canary Island currents, which are natural vectors that create this zone for fish mating, which makes it extremely rich compared to other places on the African coast. Mauritania and Western Sahara are some of the richest fishery zones actually in the continent. And that's where the China connection begins, even though that it's a story that's been near about 50 some years in the making.
Well, I mean, you would think I'd be the most interested in China's role in your country, but actually, no, I'm more interested in about the Rickat structure, the proof that Atlantis was there. So tell me more about Atlantis.
Ah, You know what? Like, the first thing that I tell you is we, the locals, pronounce it Richette.
Okay.
And that's, no, it's not your fault. You're a native English speaker. There's a subtext there, which is it's the French spelling CH instead of SH. And that's because the country was a French colony gaining its independence in 1960. And yes, and that's the one of also the reasons why the country is obscure, because it's like the its two main languages are Arabic, not widely spoken in the Western world, I guess, and French, not that widely spoken either.
Oh, I thought you were going to say it's not so well known because the elite are covering up Atlantis.
I bet you if our local elite, if they get their hands on Atlantis, be assured it's going to be on eBay in 24 hours.
Well, so just for people listening who probably have no idea what I'm talking about and think I'm crazy, I am crazy, but who was it, Socrates or Plato, who talked about Atlantis having, it was a city of concentric rings? Well, this, how do you say it, Rick?
Richette
structure, yes, is like this weird series of like concentric rings, this weird dome-shaped concentric rings in the middle of Mauritania that some people think is Atlantis, the remnants of.
Yeah, there's actually a more interesting point there, my friend.
Oh, please.
Richette is one of the few natural landmarks that astronauts can see from space.
Ooh.
And use to navigate and guide. Like in terms of relative position, like visually,
yeah.
And there is a bit of a joke here. I mean, it's a little bit of insider's baseball, but it's just, as you pointed out, it's a series of concentric circles. But the name that the locals use for it actually means wings, which like is a bit weird. It's like they didn't know. Because people didn't quite realize the structure until the advent of aviation, which is sometime in the 40s, late 40s, early 50s, and just like about 10, 11 years before the French left the country, they discovered an anomaly, which is like whenever they flew over the northern region of the country, which starts at Richette and goes north, they noticed that the airplane's compasses would go haywire.
Ooh.
And the result was, lo and behold, massive iron ore deposits. Mauritania is one of the top iron ore producers in the world.
Mm. Well, I imagine the fact that you can see the structure from space was very useful to the ancient astronauts.
Oh, I guess. I'm sure they too would have at some point needed a visual reference point if they were landing at 18,000 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what is China's interest in Atlantis?
So there's a little bit of, like, think of this as like sort of an accidental story. The Chinese, or to be more accurate, the Chinese Communist Party interest in this country, which was at the time in the mid 60s, was literally just a massive arid desert for all intents and purposes. Is that at the time Mauritania, 4 years fresh from independence, and dealing, like playing a complex geopolitical game because its northern neighbor, Morocco, had aspirations and claims on the land, claiming that they owned the country and should be part of Morocco. So the Mauritanians were playing this complex game, and lo and behold, in 1964, they were basically trying to beat the Moroccans at their own game, which is international diplomacy and multilateralism, using the non-alignment form, which many probably listeners don't either are too young to remember or have never heard of, which was like this block of nations at the time that was trying to play this sly game of being neutral, i.e. non-aligned, to either the Soviet bloc or the Western bloc. And so the Mauritanians were amongst the first countries on the African continent to recognize the communist rule in China as the legitimate Chinese, like representative of China instead of Taiwan.
The Republic of China.
Yes. And that way they got their vote in order to bypass the Moroccans, trying basically to sideline Mauritania and isolate it. But also they, it was the beginning of a relationship where until China took off, meaning economically, the relationship was always warm because the Mauritanians never missed an opportunity to remember to remind the communist government that, look, we recognize you where nobody, where the rest, when the rest of the world shunned you.
You never forget your first.
Exactly. And sort of the Chinese kind of reciprocated by doing, at the time, these modest projects by I guess international standards, but they were significant by local standards, like building a 10,000 spectator stadium, which was a nice addition, helping with a bunch of road infrastructure projects, and then ultimately, more significantly, building a new entire port, which was ultimately turned Mauritania into a strategic player because Mali, the next nation on the right, is landlocked, and Burkina Faso, the nation after that, is also landlocked, and sort of a lot of the maritime imports usually went through Senegal in the south. But when the Chinese built the ports for the Mauritanians in 1985, that injected a new economic activity into Mauritania.
1985 was a while ago. Is that the...
Exactly.
New Kids on the Block were popular in 1985.
Well, I was thinking more like, this sounds like the proto Belt and Road in some ways.
Exactly. And it was like basically...
Like step by step, you know?
Yes. Think of it, this is when the policy towards Africa was more bilateral, where the Chinese were dealing with country per country and based on like sort of reciprocal relationships. And by the way, I should add is that in the 70s, the local Chinese embassy and the local cultural their local cultural center initially started dabbling, handing out Mao Zedong books. And there was actually part of, like, there was a small communist movement in the country, which was Maoist by inspiration. Mm. However, the Mauritanian government, and this is very interesting, like, kind of sternly told the Chinese off, and they backed off.
Oh, they did back off.
Yeah, of course. Again, remember, this is China in right after Mao Zedong, and with Deng Xiaoping, and very polite and not pushy.
Well, so it sounds like the initial Chinese relation was actually very beneficial for Mauritania.
Yes, it was very beneficial, and it was even keeled. And that's why I'm explaining this, because the listeners usually, they hear about Chinese encroachment in Africa or in other regions in light of the last 10 years or the last 15 years. Hmm. But they don't understand that there's a history that goes back, and where you have a reference point for where you can see China was a rather decent partner. If you put aside my, like, people like me will never be able to forget, like, the atrocities of the Chinese Communist Party. But even if you isolate that, put it aside, but like, you can see that, okay, you could have a deal with China without selling your soul. Whereas now, what it's been happening in the last 10, 15 years, especially in Africa, where you could not do a deal with China without selling your soul.
Mm-hmm. Well, even back then, Mauritania wasn't exactly a free country.
It wasn't. And it's still actually, but if we speak strictly by Freedom House standards, Mauritania is not a full-fledged democracy. But the difference is that at the time, Mauritania was not beholden to China. They couldn't just squeeze it and say, hey, you have to pay us all right now or we'll bankrupt you, or you have to do this and this and this.
Well, it sounds like, based on what you said, has that changed? Is Mauritania now beholden to China?
Increasingly, yes. And that's like sort of there's this in particular case, which actually, again, goes back to the fisheries. There's you have to understand that Mauritania's GDP total is $5 billion.
Whoa.
A chunk of change. And its main export sources of income are fisheries, iron ore, gold. There's a little oil, and now they're discovering major natural gas discoveries offshore, which Chinese are not involved in that. Apparently they tried, but for some reason it didn't work. And sort of basically Mauritania's 30% of its GDP comes from the fisheries. Mm. And the corrupt Mauritanian government went ahead and signed a 25-year exclusivity deal with the Chinese company. It's called the Fujian Hondong Fisheries, and by the way, it merits its own investigation because I suspect that it's part of the Poly. The China Poly Corporation, which is basically the arm of commercial arm of the Chinese military, but that's slightly separate conversation. So they signed this deal, giving them 25 years exclusivity with minimum restrictions on how and what and when they can fish things, and for supposedly a series of investments of $100 million, which we never really materialized, including creating 2,500 local jobs. This this deal was signed in 2011, and the opposition and the local fishers went up in arms against it. Because comparatively, even if we accept the public figure of $100 million investment, it's a $100 million investment over 25 years. Whereas the European Union, which negotiates a fishery deal regularly, pays 100 to 140 million euros per year of fishing.
Per year?
Per year.
So right, why? Right.
But here's what I don't understand. Because you said if the GDP is like $5.5 billion and fisheries are 30% of that, then you're talking about it's a $1.6 billion dollar industry, right? Fishing.
Yes. Yes.
So Mauritania traded that for a promise of $100 million investment.
Exactly.
That's insane.
I don't. Exactly. That makes no sense.
No, that's exactly again corrupt authoritarian regimes that the Chinese government basically strikes deals with. Without any concern, without any ethical compunctions or et cetera, because what? The Chinese need their fish. We're going to go get our fish, and we're going to get it at the best price that we can get, because what are we going to give in return? Chunk of change. They want, which brings me to the second part of this, which is they've done construction projects, but this is how they usually go. The Mauritanian part, or by the way, any ex-African nation or Asian nation, comes and signs, gets like a credit from the Chinese government at insanely high interest rates, by the way, and says, you have 1 billion or 500 million, whatever the amount, that is going to be spent to give you this facility. And then there would be, by the way, part of the money is going to go to the Chinese labor we're going to bring. So that's not going into the local economy. And when that Chinese labor comes, total isolation from the population, they build their own camps, they farm their own food and work on the project and leave. So and like, for example, one of the promises of this Fujian Hondong deal is that they're gonna create a factory that's gonna create jobs for the Mauritanians. It didn't quite happen, and more importantly, the Chinese trailers and ships come and fish without any sort of regulation or surveillance. And the local fishers who live from this have been noticing a decline in the productivity of the sea. They're not able to fish the same quantities at the same intensities as before.
Right. Well, the advantage of a deal that's limited to 25 years is the Chinese company doesn't need to worry about sustainability.
No, that was the third thing that I wanted to share with you, because the president who signed this deal is no longer out of in office. He's out of office. He left back in June, but he's still a menace looming on the country, which is again another story for another time. Went on a visit last year to China, and he visited the company, and the company's chairman, according to the local Mauritanian local press, actually rather candidly started talking about what a great deal was struck with the Mauritanians. We have a 50-year deal.
Wait, 50?
50. That's what the Mauritanians discovered. Basically, the government lied to the population.
What?
Yep.
Well, so Matt, you're wrong. It's 50 years of sustainability.
It's 50 years of depleting by the time they're going to be done with it. There's not going to be left a fish in the ocean in that place.
Wow. And so what is the reason that the Mauritanian government chose China? Is it one of those things where, like, money from the EU comes with calls for, like, social reform, whereas China's exactly. money does not? So because they
not
didn't
only
want...
That, not only that, mm-hmm. but... Again, everything, again, looking at the pattern of the guy, his name is Mohammed Abdelaziz. That's the name of the general who signed this deal. He is notorious for commissions. Mm. And as you know, from precedents in other countries, I'm not in a court of law, but using precedent from other countries, you know that the Chinese are famous for the kickbacks. And the kickbacks here were, first of all, we don't quite know we don't know what is really in those contracts.
Evidently.
And sort of the local partners who are doing logistical services for the Chinese company are his people.
Huh.
Mm. You know, I realize that we've made a big mistake on this show. Because, mm-hmm. like, activists never give us kickbacks.
Yes.
Wait.
So we chose the wrong side.
Nasser, you're not giving us a kickback for this?
I wish.
No. We wish.
No, I wish, because you're going to be doing my bidding, and I hope that, like, someday I can host you in Mauritania over a great fish dinner.
If there's any fish left.
There's another story for you. Last time I was in Spain with my wife, the Canary Islands, which are not far from Mauritania, we went to this fish restaurant, and then we ordered, and then we kind of looked at the guy and he's like, "Oh, where did you get this fish from?" He looks at us and says, "From your country."
Ooh, how did that make the fish taste?
Well, it was bittersweet, because ultimately I'm enjoying the fish, but I know very well that the people who should be fed by this, should be enriched by this, are not.
So not only is China screwing Mauritania over with these bad deals, it's also essentially preventing the country from getting better deals with the West that might actually help the country develop.
I think that actually that phrasing is very charitable. I would say that the Chinese are looking at this as a plunder-free zone, and that they're going to go, like, basically this is an open buffet where they're going to just go serve themselves and be damned whatever is left there. We don't care. We're just going to scrap the bottom of the sea, and that's that.
Jeez, and if they get all that ancient Atlantean technology, we're all doomed.
We are. Yes, that word that I cannot use on a podcast.
Well, thank you.
speaking of Atlantis, you mentioned that there's big iron ore deposits in Mauritania.
Yes. The iron ore, by the way, itself is another story, because when, as I told you, the French discovered it by sheer accident. Because remember, when they colonized that territory, they colonized it under the assumption that this is just a vast swath of desert. We don't care about, like, it's not going to provide us anything. We're colonizing it because of its position, location, connecting our North African colonies with our West African colonies. And they actually didn't put any effort into finding whether there's any, hence the late discovery of the iron ore, which happened the work on this began in 1954, 6 years before independence. And then they had this this company, which is majority shares held by the French, that was there until 1974, when the Mauritanians decided basically to be like, no, we need to revise this. We're taking over. See you. Here are your shares. Bye bye. And the Chinese used to buy iron ore. And they still, but they haven't quite gotten a foothold in exploring, actually in owning the mines, because Western partners began doing that before them. And just to give you another example of the corruption of General Aziz, the state-owned parastatal SNIM, which is basically Mauritania's equivalent of Aramco in Saudi Arabia, which is like this giant company, which is really a state inside the state, that is in charge of extracting iron ore and mining it. It had this one giant deposit that was supposed to sustain the country's production for a century at a rate of 5,000 tons a year for a century of iron ore. And that's worth a lot of money, depending on however you calculate it. He went and struck a deal with an Australian company to sell it for $1 billion.
Oh, wow. That's way, way under what it should be worth.
Exactly. Thank God that deal ultimately sank, but you get the picture.
Sank like Atlantis.
Yes, and hopefully never to be found. And again, this gives you, this is another lesson, which is, yes, the Chinese Communist Party practices are terrible and devoid of any ethical considerations or moral considerations, but it takes two to tango. That's the lesson here, that the Chinese deals in Africa and Asia are greedy, but it's not like they don't have a willing partner who does this with them. And usually that's why the Chinese are very close to dictatorships and tyrants, because they will do their bidding for a cut.
So you said that General Aziz is no longer the president. Does that make a difference in these deals?
You know, that's probably, I would say, the billion-dollar question, because we don't know if the new government and the new president is going to listen to his popular demands and revise some of these agreements. We don't know. Of course, me and a lot of Mauritanians, I would vote for the guy, even though that I swore to never vote for anybody who's ever been in the military. But I would vote for him if he canceled the deal with the Chinese on the fisheries. That's how critical this thing is, in my opinion. Because it's not only about depleting a natural resource, it's destroying entire communities that are living on those natural resources. We have these communities. This is a unique community of people called the Imregen. And these are native people. No one quite knows their history because they've been there before anybody. And these guys have this unique relationship with the sea. These are guys who figured out how to work with dolphins to fish.
What?
Yes. Even though that they're Muslims like the rest of the population, but they have their own rituals related to the sea that you can clearly tell that these are pre-Islamic animist traditions that they still hold on till today. That community is going to be destroyed if this thing keeps it, like if the fish dries out.
That sounds magical.
I know. I need more explanation.
You know, the true history of the Imregan is they're the descendants of
the Atlanteans.
Exactly.
I don't think they...
it's the only logical explanation.
I mean, how else would the dolphins
listen to them? Yeah, these are people like think of them as the equivalent of the native inhabitants, like the tribes in the Amazon, who are completely in sync with their environment, who can tell you about every insect, tree, and a bush in their environment. These guys are the same thing, but with the ocean.
Wow.
So they're not super happy about the giant Chinese fishing trawlers.
Yeah, I mean, no. They're and not only that. I mean, to be fair, is that overfishing has been a problem in the last 30 years. But this Chinese deal in particular, because it's like without, like for example, when the Europeans sign, there's a biological pause. You can't fish for X period of time. There are certain species you cannot touch. There are certain types of nets you cannot use. There are certain methods of fishing you cannot use. None of these restrictions exist on the Chinese. So as a result, when I was a teenager, we like sort of in the height of the fishing season, we would go to the port in October, between October and January, which was the peak season. We would go, and I'm talking here 1986, 1985, 1987, 1988. We would go in the and basically set camp at the port. And what we were, in a sense, doing, we were fishing and catching at a rate of 10 to every 10, 15 minutes. And what we were concerned about at the time is whatever we were actually trying to catch, just one type of fish. Anything else that came out, we'd throw it back in. That's the abundance that existed. That's no longer the case. There were no biological pauses in the 80s. When they first started them, there were biological pauses of 15 days, then stretched to 1 month. Now they are 3 months.
So no fishing for 3 months to try to
restock. Basically give time to fish to for fish to reproduce. So like this is a disaster by every standard. And on the anecdote that I shared with you about me and my wife eating Mauritanian fish in the Canary Islands, the sad truth is that because the way the sector is created, the best types of fish go get exported, and the locals are left only with sort of like the lower quality stuff. And so like fishing, even though you would think that Mauritania has these massive fishing resources, it should have food security and protein security, where that's not the case. Mauritania is constantly food critical.
Wow.
So the lives of your average Mauritanian is not very good.
No. I mean, I told you, GDP of 5 billion for 4 million people, life expectancies of 47 to 50 years. It's basically two hurricanes meeting each other. Super corrupt, bad governance, and super predatory foreign exploitation.
Well, another thing I'm wondering is, because of its location, is there a possibility that China could see it as a potential military base?
Funny you ask that. So...
Why do I have a feeling I'm not going to be laughing?
Yeah. Actually, when I heard the news the first time, I wasn't laughing either. There is this port, like area called Njegu, which is about 80 to 100, no, 100 kilometers south of the capital, Nouakchott. The Nouakchott is the capital of the country, and it's on the ocean. There's this area called Ndjegu, where actually the Chinese were constructing a port there. But it seems that that project stopped into its tracks. And you didn't hear it from me, but let's say that some Western countries heard about it, and they seem to have had a word with the Mauritanians.
Now, when you say we didn't hear it from you, you understand this is a podcast that will be recorded and played.
Yes, you didn't hear it from me is a euphemism of about me being a behind the scenes guy.
Okay.
Wait, so I don't understand what the Western companies, the Western governments said about Ndjegu.
No, Ndjegu, I would tell you, Ndjegu, if the Chinese had their way and completed a military facility on the ocean, that is for one purpose and one purpose only, which is
peaceful. China's peaceful rise.
Well, I mean, China is free to rise just in their country, not on my soil. A port in Ndjegu means one thing only, which is the Chinese are building a blue navy capability, and having a naval base in that area of the world is a strategic asset. And that basically would allow the Chinese to project power not only in the strategic parts of Africa, but even transatlantic.
Right. Now, a lot of people say, well, America has blue ocean capabilities. America has bases and Navy bases around the world. So what's the difference with, you know, why shouldn't China be allowed to have them?
Oh, you see, that's an interesting question because that hits it's very close home. If I were to speak as a Mauritanian, by the way, and I am an American by choice, if I were to speak as a Mauritanian, I would tell you again is that Mauritania is a small country. We want to be friends with everybody, but we don't want some foreign bases in our territory to be used for whatever purposes. As an American, I would tell you is that, look, the United States, there's a lot of criticism that could be made about U.S. foreign policy over the last 50 years. But there's one thing. If you're a friend with America, there are dividends. You don't get rubbed blind the way that happens to countries that are friends with China. And the second thing is that the Chinese are driven by an ideological project, which I'm not sure is compatible with the notions and the ideas of democracy, people rule, and human rights. So there's I get it that a lot of people are sour with past American foreign policy failures, but I would take the United States any day over Chinese communist influence.
So are you saying all of the problems of Africa are not caused by white people?
I am saying that I would say that the problems of Africa are caused by corrupt rulers who didn't come from the moon. These are native people who were born there. And I would say that other parts of problems of Africa have been caused by white people over the past century. And I would say that now we have the Chinese Communist Party trying to take the place of the white people and start behaving like the white people of the 19th century, not the white people of the 21st century.
So that's not good.
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, I was going to ask how the Mauritanians feel about China.
In the 80s, in the 70s and the 80s, even to the 90s, Mauritanian public opinion was very positive about China because China was seen as this foreign partner that didn't meddle in internal affairs and generally had a very light footprint. They'd come, they'd make projects, shake hands, see you. And the Mauritanian sort of at some point, and this is a true story, at some point in sometime around 1997-98, there was a high level Chinese delegation that comes to visit, and they were like basically. The bilateral talks, and sort of the Chinese were reminding their Mauritanian government partner, like sort of counterparts, saying, "Hey, by the way, you guys seem to have forgotten. We still have money from the last aid package that we gave you that you haven't used. What do you want us to do with it?" And so the Mauritanians were scratching their heads, and then they were like, "Yeah, build us a new presidential palace." So that was the perception of the Chinese. It's like a little bit of a Santa that comes and does things, and then sends you every now and then could send doctors, etc. Who basically there was no historical contentious or historical grievances whatsoever with the Chinese.
So at what point did Chinese Santa turn evil?
Sometime around the 2000s.
Why?
I guess Jiang Zemin. Sorry, I was just coughing. Jiang Zemin.
Yes. It's around the time of Jiang Zemin and sort of this, I mean, the historical mistake that the Clinton administration made, which was like thinking that giving China access to the World Trade Organization and that somehow the Chinese are going to mellow down and start behaving like the rest of the nations. And that they'll stop being communists. China is in the process of building an empire. And when you're building an empire, contention is that the Chinese, part of the tragedy of the Chinese is that they're coming to this whole empire building after empire became ran out of fashion. And building empire, is something that requires a lot of nasty dealing and wielding. And the Chinese are unfazed by that. And they came to the conclusion that, like, they see Africa as this huge, a combination of a huge iron ore or mine, oil field, and natural resources depository, and also a huge market to dump in all of their products, and sort of they want to capture it. And some people, somewhat cynically, point out that the Chinese are trying to do in Africa what European powers did to China in the 18th and the 19th century.
Well, I learned from watching Chinese movies like Wolf Warrior that the Chinese are actually, you know, peaceful people who are saving the Africans.
Through war, because it's Wolf Warrior.
Bad Americans.
Well, I wouldn't... Again, for example, a few years ago, I think around 2011, 2012, at the height of the Arab uprisings, in Algeria, which didn't have an Arab Spring, there was a huge riot that broke out, and there are like over 30 wounded. Basically, the locals went after the local Chinatown because they put the local weavers, textile business, factories and producers out of business. And the population was super angry. And wherever you go in the continent today, people are souring over the Chinese over two things, because they see them as basically enabling and empowering their dictators, like as in the case in Zimbabwe, in Zambia, in Mauritania, and in other places. And then and sort of like China is no longer seen as like sort of the benevolent, brotherly fellow poor country, which was the image in the 70s and the 80s.
I have a question about the Chinese loans that are going to Mauritania, or more like the payments, right, in exchange for the fishing rights. Are those payments being made in Chinese renminbi or in dollars or in the local currency?
We don't know because no one quite saw the agreements that were actually signed. There were copies that were published by the government, which we came later to know that they were either not complete or censored, and that detail isn't there.
I only ask because if you get your Chinese loan in Chinese currency, like, you can't just go down to your local currency exchange, shop and change it for whatever. Like, it's too much money for that, right? So you basically have to use that to buy Chinese goods.
Yes, correct. And by the way, speaking of all of this, I invite anyone who has some time on their hand, who know Chinese, to go investigate these, like what is available out there in Chinese on Chinese websites about these deals, because we're a little bit operating blindly. The government is lying to us, not telling us all the picture, and sporadically we find things that the Chinese said, but we can't quite read what they're saying. So there's a knowledge gap that needs to be bridged.
Well, great. So anyone listening who thinks they can do that, you know, do that work. We can connect that. We can connect people to that.
No, it would be a great help to actually know what the Chinese are saying about this and what they're promising. Because, again, sporadically, because that's the difficulty of for people who live in sort of these kind of authoritarian or semi-authoritarian regimes who are corrupt and opaque, is that we don't really know half of the time. We don't really know what's going on. And like, for example, 2 years ago, the Chinese handed two new combat vessels to the Mauritanian Navy at a discounted price. At least that's what the Mauritanian government told the population. And, you know, knowing China's precedents, is like, wait, well, they're not going to give anything for free. There must be a counterpart. What was it?
What was it? Did you ever find out?
Again, we suspect that it was like a sweetener that was thrown into the mix after the Chinese realized that there's massive popular resistance and rejection of the fisheries deal. And again, the Chinese all the time are trying to they have actually two sour spots in Mauritania, which they're always trying to dance around. The first one is obviously the fisheries deal. And the second one is the issue of the Uyghurs. Because again, remember, Mauritania is a 100% Muslim country. And the Mauritanian population, like, once they find out the full picture about what has been done to the Uyghurs in China, I think that will become a little bit of a problem for them, because the Mauritanian government will be also in a pretty sticky position. If the population finds out and starts protesting, China and the government will have a problem on its hands. Of course, the issue is that they don't, like, the population doesn't fully know what's going on. And I would say that the Chinese have always been they entice the government. Like, here's an example: after the President Trump started the trade war, the Chinese started propagandizing through their embassy in Nuakchot. They even issued a white paper that they distributed to the local press about the trade war, and basically it was the Chinese version of the story, which is America bad, 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 and China good, good, good. So the U.S. embassy in Nuakchot just published one Facebook post where they talked about China's treatment of the Uyghurs. Chinese went berserk.
Ooh.
But how did the Chinese even know? Because they're not allowed to access Facebook.
Well, clearly in Mauritania they do.
So
they use Facebook in Mauritania.
You mentioned briefly that there were protests, or there was like a, not protests, but like a lot of public opposition.
No, there were protests by fishers in 2011 by the opposition. There were even blows were traded at the parliament.
Do you think there could ever, it could ever get to the point, like let's say the Chinese Communist Party keeps kind of overstepping or taking advantage of Mauritania in a way that it gets out more and more to the public. It, recently, what happened in Malaysia was that, you know, when they voted out their corrupt prime minister and the new prime minister came in and was like, we have to renegotiate all these China deals. Do you think something like that could happen in Mauritania?
I pray to God that something like that happens in Mauritania. Because, as I mentioned to you, it's just like all you have to do is open the annual report about Mauritania and the World Bank, and you'll understand that this stuff is not kids' play. This is vital. Like I would go as far as and say that the future of an entire generation of people hangs onto this. So I hope to God that something like that happens. But I would, if I were to add something, is that knowing how the Mauritanian ruling class is, they're not to them, China has been this cow that they could milk that gives them things without too many strings attached, strings that they care about, of course, meaning a scrutiny over human rights, democracy, rule of law, transparency, none of that. And China becomes basically a quick cash stop where they can give them projects and things they tout in front of their population saying, look, we did these great things, without really ever thinking about the consequences. But if I had to volunteer a thought on this entire front, I would say that if the Mauritanians and that entire area, West Africa, North Africa, were to find out more about what is done to the Uyghurs in China, that could be a game changer.
It's an interesting idea, a sort of worldwide Islamic backlash against the Chinese Communist Party.
It's the more all pertinent because, morally speaking, it is absolutely, I speak here as a Muslim, I am absolutely outraged that the other day when the UN started talking about, like, sort of discussed the issue of the Uyghurs, the only country that stood out there clearly against what is done to the Uyghurs were Western countries. Mm. Not one Muslim nation said a thing.
I wonder if it's a similar situation where the governments of those countries are getting nice Chinese kickbacks and...
Yeah, absolutely. Like Saudi Arabia, they don't want to upset the Chinese Communist Party because they see China as a substitute in terms of oil market. They see it as a substitute to the American market, which has become auto-sufficient with the shale oil. The UAE, they don't want to mess with the Chinese. They'd rather do trade business deals with them. Turkey kind of grumbles. Like they host Uyghurs and they talk about it, but they don't rock the boat. They don't rock the boat too much either. Indonesia, mum. Malaysia, mum. You'd think Pakistan is like one of the biggest Muslim nations on earth? No, because China is their sugar daddy, their military ally that is providing them with military hardware, financial aid, and political support in the UN against India. So again, this kind of like all of this shows you that this whole notion of like all the Muslims are all, you know, one team and watching for each other's back, that's a myth.
Yeah, because in this case, Saudi Arabia and Iran agree on one thing. They love China.
Exactly. That was Matt, I thank you for saying that because you literally, that was the next thing that I was going to say.
Wow. Well, so what would you say to other countries that are dealing with the prospect of Chinese foreign investment?
I would say that, like, if China, judging by what happened in places like Sri Lanka, Zambia, and others like Montenegro, Serbia, Greece. If the Chinese get the opening, what will happen basically is that they will shackle the country in debt that it can never pay and will start extracting concessions in old-fashioned colonial style. They will build a port, and then they will start demanding and getting access to the mineral. By the way, Mauritania is rich in minerals. It's like it has, as I mentioned, iron ore. It has significant gold deposits. There's uranium deposits. There are copper deposits. There are gypsum deposits. And now there's natural gas, which has been exploited by BP, but the deal has not been closed yet. So the BP being British Petroleum, which is a gigantic natural gas offshore field, which is going to be exploited jointly by Mauritania and Senegal. Who knows? They could. Next thing you know, you start, like, one day you wake up and the Chinese look at you and say, "Hey, time to pay up the bill. The interest rate is piling up. What are you going to give us? We want the gas. We want the iron, or we want the gold. What would the Mauritanians be able to do? Nothing. Because again." Circling back to the beginning of the episodes, is that most of the listeners, I would bet you that like 99% of the listeners would have never heard even of the word Mauritania, let alone knowing that it's such a country, and that 1% probably would spell it Mauritania, thinking it's the old British ship.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair. When I first met you and you told me you were from Mauritania, the next thing I did is Google Mauritius.
Exactly. I get that every day. I got it actually from my Lyft driver yesterday. He was like, "Where are you from?" I was like, "Yeah, I'm from Boston, but I was born in Mauritania." Oh, he was like, "Yeah, Mauritius, great place."
You know what? Matt kind of gaslit me on that, because like I was like, "Oh, we should have Nasser on to talk about Mauritania," and then like he was like, "Yes, Mauritius," and I was like, "Is he from Mauritius?" And I got it wrong.
Yeah, no, I was just gaslighting you.
So I got into the habit of saying Mauritius is the beautiful island in the Indian Ocean. Mauritania is the sand island on the western coast.
Well. Great. Thank you so much for joining us and telling us all these horrible things.
it makes you want to visit Mauritania, huh?
Actually, yeah. I want to see Atlantis.
I'd kind of rather visit Mauritius.
So if somebody wanted to know more about you or what you do, where should they go?
I guess like I'm available on Twitter at Weddady, WEDDADY. I occasionally write in places like the New York Times, the Washington Post. And again, hey, if you ever have any questions, etc., tweet me at Weddady on Twitter.
Well, great. Yeah. Once again, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me. And one day, maybe we can have a Mauritanian fish dinner.
That sounds excellent to me.
There's only a few years left for that.
Yeah. Well, we can get some in the Canary Islands.
We have to go to China Uncensored in Africa.
In the meantime, you could always get like those posters of the Reshat structure. There's satellite pictures of it. And it's a gorgeous thing to have on the wall.
I agree. I like it.
It's called,
a fancy
it's called
thing.
The Eye of the Sahara. That's what the astronauts call it.
Ooh. All right. Well, great. Yeah. Yeah. So that's it. Thank you. Yeah. Podcast is over. Thank you.
Actually, I was about to say that I'm a big fan of China's Uncensored.
All right. Thank you. I know it's because we have such a smooth use of language.
great transitions.
Yeah.
And so, thank you for having me. I've been a huge fan of China Uncensored. And I discovered it by accident on YouTube. And this is a show that changed entirely my perspective about China. Because before that, I thought, like most people, that, yeah, I know what China is about. It was China Uncensored that really, really made me rethink everything that I assumed to know about the Chinese government.
Wow. Wow. Thank you.
My pleasure. And the credit goes to all of you guys. And hey, I would tell the listeners, if you are not already donating to the 50 Cent Army, go for it on Patreon.
Wow. Hey, thanks. Thank you. I really appreciate that. Hey, that Mauritanian fish dinner, it's on me. All right. Well, yeah, thanks again for talking to us. But yeah, seriously, the podcast is over. Please leave. Well, that was fun, guys, don't you think?
I always learn so much from these podcasts.
I want to know more about those dolphin riders.
Right? So why hasn't anybody made a movie about that?
I know. Hey, that'll be the first uncensored production movie.
I don't think we should call the production company Uncensored Productions.
Okay, Uncovered
Productions. Unscripted Productions. There we go.
All right. For documentaries. And definitely, you know, that would be the first topic that we'd cover with all our knowledge.
Dolphin Riders of Atlantis.
There we go. It's a good title, though.
It is.
That sounds like a Disney movie.
Kind of.
It can be a combination documentary and animated Disney movie. It's never been done before.
That's the kind of thing you can expect from Unscripted Productions.
It's kind of neither dolphin nor fowl.
Dolphin. Hey, isn't the Chinese for dolphin like pig of the sea?
Wait, now I have to think about what the Chinese for dolphin is.
It's like hai tsun or something.
You know what? I've never had to use the term dolphin.
You haven't had to use dolphin in Chinese very often? Who's going to be faster on this?
Yeah, but it's... Okay, the main... It is pig, but like not a very used word for pig.
Dolphins, the pig of the sea. Delicious.
Because it's hai tsun, but like people usually use zhu for dolphin.
You mean pig?
For pig, yes. So right. I was like, are they called hai zhu? I don't remember that.
Pigs of the sea. And hey. The best thing to drink if you're eating a dolphin is
what?
Tea.
What?
That's my transition, Shelley. What?
How did we go from riding dolphins to eating dolphins?
Oh, the pig of the sea. Delicious. All right. So, you know, tea is good to have on its own. So if you'd like some tea, go to go.pathofcha.com/unscripted. And get some tea. Tonight we're drinking the Yellow Goddess Huang Guangyin Wuyi Rock Oolong Tea. It's a delicious one. And, man, yeah. Thanks for listening to China Unscripted. Once again, I'm Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley Zhang.
And I'm Matt Gnezda.
Talk to you next time.